know some of you. It's a pleasure to be able to meet many of those of you that I don't know, and pleasure to renew old acquaintances. I've given this talk many times, as you can imagine, and it gets harder every time I give it, because I find that the more I go in life, the more that the meeting with Baba really means to me. And the more it really means to me, the less I can put it into words. And I'm not saying that to try to be mystical or mysterious or anything, but it's really true that Baba has a touch that is so profound and so meaningful for every situation that I've found myself in life, that I can continually refer to just that 5 or 10 minutes that Baba gave me in every situation that I find myself for strength, for inspiration, for guidance, for meaning, whatever I need, if I can remember to make that reference. And so it is to tell chronologically and externally, I mean, a story of 5 minutes with what the avatar did with one fellow from the West. But as Tex Hightower once said on a radio program in New York, when somebody said, well, what was it like to meet Baba? He said to the announcer, he said, well, you realize when you ask me to tell about that, you're asking really for the meaning of my life. So there's just so much beneath the surface of the iceberg that is impossible for me to explain, but I'll be glad to share with you what went on externally. And I'd also like to go into some of the ways in which that has integrated into my life, and why, given my personality and the destiny that I've had since then, Baba was doing what he was doing, as far as I'm able to know that at this point in my growth as a person. I think a little background is necessary for you to understand it. If for some reason you can't hear or anything, just holler, because I'll be glad to shout or whatever. I was a... I think it's probably a little easier to stand. Can you pick it up on the mic if I stand?
I think if I move
it forward. I wasn't ever the all-American boy, so I wouldn't say that I went over to Baba as a representative of Americana and apple pie and all that. I never was really happy as a young boy. I mean, I did well in school and had success and all that, but it didn't make me happy. I was always looking, and everybody I knew always told me, why don't you just be happy with what you got? I mean, you seem to be getting good grades in school, and no, I got into Harvard and all that, and that was supposed to symbolize success, and my parents were proud of me and all that. But underneath, it really didn't matter what people told me. I just knew that I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't happy. And time after time, people my own age and people of an adult generation would tell me that, you know, I was searching for something that I would never find, and that I just had to learn how to be happy and adjust. So that's one of the great psychological cliches, you know, just adjust, accept things as they are, they'll never be better, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I tried that. I really, for something in me said, well, I mean, if I drop out or quit or go against the grain when I was in high school or college, then I don't know, I'll always look at myself as kind of a failure. And if I'm unhappy, maybe the reason will be that I didn't complete high school, or I didn't try my best, or I didn't complete college and I didn't try my best. So I just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it, and it was like, you know, Sisyphus pushing his rock up the hill, and there was just no fruition, there was no satisfaction for me. So when I got to my senior year in college, I just knew that, you know, a life of doing what I was doing wasn't going to be happy. There was just no point. It was as clear as the nose on my face that to continue doing what I was doing was to lead a life of being unsatisfied and unhappy. So I had reached a state of desperation, not a wild, you know, frantic state of desperation, but I wasn't happy doing what I was doing, and I'd better find something else. But I didn't know what that something else was. I first got turned on to drugs in 1963, smoked grass and took some peyote, I never had LSD, so I didn't get too heavily into the psychedelics, but I did, you know, have grass and a little peyote, as I say. I think what drugs did for me was to make me aware that there were states of consciousness that were different from our present, and that gave me a little bit of a push to take some of these mystics and other people that I began to read later on a little more seriously, gave them some credibility to me. And when I was a senior in college in Boston in 1964, I became interested in a mystic called Gurdjieff. Some of you probably know something about him. But there was a Gurdjieff group in Boston, and I started attending their meetings and so forth. And Gurdjieff made sense to me. He inspired me. I liked him. I liked what he did. I liked his lifestyle. I liked what he had to say. And there was a guy who led the group who had been with Gurdjieff and who talked about it. And I realized that he was somebody who had faced some of the larger problems in life and made at least some progress in developing himself as a human being. And that turned me on. That excited me. That meant a lot to me. And he wasn't doing it in terms of, you know, that getting a job and making a lot of money and living in the suburbs was where it was at. He was doing it in mystical terms, that you had to understand the nature of consciousness and how to be human and what feeling was and what mentality was and what the body was, and you had to understand the meaning of life and how you fit into the whole picture. And it was exciting because it seemed to me that psychology, which is one of the other Western alternatives, didn't really do that. They talked a language that I didn't like and I didn't feel in and didn't have an explanation of the outer universe and the outer existence that the individual could harmonize with. So I was doing that and got interested in yoga, and one incredible thing kept leading to another. I had a very dear friend named Brian Silver who was a classmate of mine or a year ahead of me, and he was passionately interested in India. And he taught himself about 8 or 9 stringed instruments, including the sitar. And he got a Fulbright to India. And during my senior year in college, which was 64 to 65, he wrote letters to me and talked about the joys and the beauties of India. Brian was an extraordinarily gifted writer, and his letters were enchanting. They were poetic. And I'd always had a yen to travel, and gradually mysticism and the interest in mysticism and the desire to travel and the desire to go to India began to awaken in me. And I think when I really knew that I wanted to go to India, I didn't know about Baba at the time, was Nehru died in about October or November 64. And the Indian community in America was quite shocked and a little confused about what was going to happen to India, because the whole independence movement really rode on the backs of two men, Nehru and Gandhi. And when Gandhi was shot, that left Nehru, and he was the head of state. And without such a strong figure, I think India probably would have been in a lot of trouble. And the Indian community was very upset about his death and confused. But they were very moved, and they had several exhibitions in the United States. And one of them was in a big office building in New York, where they had just a complete exhibition devoted to Nehru. And there were many, many pictures of India and Gandhi and Nehru, and, I mean, not small things. I mean, they're about 10 feet wide and 3 feet high. And just there were two floors literally covered with pictures of Nehru and Gandhi and India. And I just felt an incredible yearning to go to India. That's the only way I can describe it. I just wandered around this place for several hours just staring at these pictures and feeling drawn, feeling that I wanted to go to India. And I couldn't explain it. It was just like being drawn by a magnet. And in fact, I wrote to my friend Brian, who was still in India. I said, is there some super Hindu over there with a large magnet who's pulling me? Well, he was a Parsi. So things were leading along, and I'd applied for a Fulbright, didn't get it, was very disappointed, and was trying to find an angle to get me to India. And my friend suggested, well, why not try the Peace Corps? Still, at this time, I didn't know about Bala. I joined the Peace Corps as a mechanism to get to India, assuming that they'd give me some job that I could do, and that would leave me in India, and that was fine. So I graduated in 1965 and sent in my Peace Corps application, and word came back, and well, between then, I've been doing a whole bunch of mystical things, Gurdjieff and Yogananda and reading Gandhi and just reading whatever I could put my hands on. And I was getting pretty sick of theoretical mysticism because my head hurt. And I wanted to find something I could practice. Gurdjieff was the most practical thing I found at that point. In the summer of 65, July or so, Rick Chapman, whom I had known since about 10th or 11th grade, who also lived in Denver at that time. We spent part of our youth in Denver together. Turned me on to Bawa. He had found out about Bawa from Alan Cohen and come out to San Francisco and met with Murshida and a few other people, seen a lot of movies, and came back with an armload of books. And those of you who know Rick know that he has a wonderful talent for sharing his enthusiasm with people. And that's exactly what Rick did with me. I mean, he came with this fantastic spirit of being inspired, and he'd found it, and it was fantastic. And I didn't want to hear it. because I just had so much of mysticism, and what he was talking about didn't seem to offer me anything to do in my daily life. And so there was a guy in India who said he was God, and that was fine. I mean, that was entertaining and everything, but it didn't mean anything to me. I mean, I was standing there in a suburb of Denver, Colorado, and so there was a guy in India who said he was God and did all these things, and there were pictures, and Rick showed me the Wayfarers, and I said, absolutely not. This guy saw all these crazy people in the Wayfarers, and I said, I mean, things were a little different in 65 because mysticism was very, very unaccepted and very unpopular at that time. It's a lot more popular now, and you find a lot more kindred spirits, so to speak, if you have an interest in mysticism. But back in 65, I can remember sitting down at the college dining hall and telling people just about yoga, hatha yoga, I mean, which you see on TV now, and people thought I was a nut, I was a kook, you know. And now businessmen do it, you know, on their lunch break and stuff, so things have changed in that short period of time. So I was worried about myself that I was going to flip out and become a kook. And Rick showed me the Wayfarers, and I thought, no, if I get into this, I'm gone. I'll lose control forever, and I just won't know where. It's like going up into outer space with no gyroscope or something. So I didn't want that. So play it cool and conservative and do the Gurdjieff exercise. That was where I was at in 65. And then I got into the Peace Corps, and I went to the Peace Corps, and we had this training program, and I met the Indians, and I really liked the Indians, and oh, all sorts of things happened. I was on the brink of leaving the Peace Corps because I didn't like them and a whole bunch of stuff. And Bawa has lots of ways of working when he draws you to him. And he's not above, at least this is purely my opinion, but he's not above using, you know, your interests in the world. I mean, if you like candies or if you like money or you like to travel or something, he draws on that. Browses on in Stay With God describes it as flattering the whims of his lovers as he draws them to him. I mean, after you know him, then he drops the kibosh on you. But when you're just coming to him, he's very gentle, and he satisfies some of the things you like to do. And what happened to me was I fell in love. I mean, it was fantastic. It was wonderful. And it was so perfect for me at that time, because after that, I mean, I was so involved with this particular person that I didn't care about the Peace Corps anymore. Whatever they did was fine. I was just going to India, and I was in love with this girl, and it was great. It was wonderful. So that actually kept me in the Peace Corps, kept me going to India, and ultimately was one of the key things that happened to me on my way to Sibal. So stayed in the Peace Corps, going to India, and let's see, in November of 1965, Sibal had... A little bit of background is kind of necessary, because in November, Bawa was planning a Sahavas at Christmas time in 1965. And there was a chartered plane in San Francisco, there was a chartered plane in New York, and all the Bawa lovers, the most in 65 was mostly the old Bawa lovers, Fred and Ella Winterfeldt and Kitty and Elizabeth and Murshida and Don Stevens and Ludd, and you know, all the old people. There are a few people starting to trickle in 65, but there still weren't too many. a lot of these people were ready to go for Sahavas, which Baba had promised. In the end of August or September, Baba canceled the Sahavas and went into seclusion, very deep seclusion. Didn't see very many people at all, except those he specifically called. And most of you are probably somewhat familiar with the story of Robert Dreyfus, who went to India and sought Baba in 1965 around November. It was sometime around Thanksgiving time. And we got a cryptic little postcard from Robert saying that I have met with Baba, which, of course, really set our hearts on fire. And at that time, I figured, well, Baba was in seclusion. I won't even make an effort to see him. But it seemed that he was Robert, and I had met him a few months before in Boston, and he seemed like a contemporary person of my age and interests and so on. And I figured, well, you know, if he got to meet Baba, maybe there's a chance for me. So that was another key link in my being able to meet Baba. And so then I began to wonder, well, now, if I want to meet Baba, how would I go about doing it? And so I dropped a letter to Sufism because I had bought my books from Sufism. And also a letter had come back from Don Stevens to Rick describing a very, very wonderful meeting with Baba and how Don had felt being in Baba's presence. And I was very touched. I was very moved by the way Don described being with Baba, because there was one phrase that Don used in that letter. He said, as always, Baba bathes you in his love. And it caught me. I really wanted to see Baba. I really wanted to see Baba. And so I wrote to Don, and I wrote to Sufism, and Carrie Harb of Sufism wrote me back suggesting that I write to Adi. Don Stevens wrote me back suggesting that I write to Adi, so it seemed like I should write to Adi. So I went to India and eventually wrote to Adi about a month later. And this was in 66. India was in a severe period of drought. I was in South India, working in a village in the Peace Corps, and Adi said, glad to hear from you, glad to hear that you're in India. I conveyed your message to Baba, and Baba wishes me to convey the message to you that he's going to make up his mind, and he would like you to write him back on February 7th, or February 7th or February 10th, one or the other. I think it was February 10th. And I had asked for my friend Diana and I, who at that time was interested in Baba, and I wrote again on the 10th, and the reply, Baba is pleased. I couldn't believe it. Baba is pleased to be able to see the both of you for 5 minutes only, sometime when he's at Guru Prasad, which in those days was from, April, May, and June. Those are the hot months. I think Baba spent the April, May, and June at Pune, at Guru Prasad, because he used to have this little phrase, in March, you all marched to Pune. So at the end of March, they would go to Pune, and so he was there for April, May, and June. So Baba wanted to see me sometime during that period. But he said, write him later and set up the dates and all of that. So a couple of letters went back and forth. My initial reaction to having to write these letters was, I mean, I was very upset that I had to write to Baba again. I mean, now I look at it as the way Baba works. Because, Baba was just playing with me, and Baba was drawing me closer. And because my schedule had to change, and therefore I had to write Baba again, it was just another opportunity to contact Baba. It was just his game, his lila. And I didn't understand that then. I thought, I was annoyed, I have to write Baba again, my schedule's gonna change, maybe I won't get to see Baba, and I was upset about the whole thing. Of course now, looking back on it, I can just see that Baba was just providing me another very precious opportunity to write him and to get a response back, which, is a fantastic opportunity. But I didn't know that, and I didn't see it in those terms. So we finally set on a date. Baba said, choose either the 8th or the 15th of April at 9 o'clock for 5 minutes only at Guru Prasad, and write me a little in advance as to which one you're going to select. So things went along, and turned out that Diana decided that she didn't want to see Baba because she felt that it was kind of my thing and that she had gotten interested in Baba through me, but that, you know, she really decided about her own interests that she didn't, on her own, want to see Baba. So she decided not to go. And so I went by myself. A lot of things happened to me in India, and just incredible things happened to me in India. But one of the things was the three people I was living with in the village, the Americans, hated my guts. It was a phenomenal experience. Why? I don't know. I'd say one of them did. That's a little strong. One of them did, and the other two kind of allowed the friction to go on. Anyway, for me, it was an unbearable situation because I was living with people who didn't like me there. There wasn't harmony. One girl didn't even come to meals because I was there. God only knows what karma I had with her. But I mean, it was incredible. I had to get out of that situation. So that's one thing. The other thing was I was having fight after fight with the Peace Corps, and I thought they were a bunch of idiots, and they probably thought the same thing of me. And so there was a lot of emotional stuff going on there. And another side of what was happening to me, I was falling madly in love with India. I was learning the language. I had Indian friends, and that was happening. And then sometime before I met Bala, something just happened, and I couldn't worry anymore. I mean, just the whole emotional thing just came to a head, and I just couldn't worry. It has nothing to do with being spiritually advanced or anything. It had to do with Bala's grace. And no matter what I did, I mean, worries wouldn't come into my brain. So I can assure you it was a fantastic experience. And it was only through Bala's grace. As I said, the boom was lowered a little later on down the pile. I thought during those days that was it. That was it. That's what you did in life. You struggled and you suffered, and then you met Bala, and that was it. Your problems were over, and you ran around the world being a living message of love and light. Now, you may laugh and say that's not, only an idiot could believe that, but when that was happening to me, I believed it. I thought my worries were over. I would never have another problem as long as I lived. My sole function to be on earth was to go around spreading love and light. And it turned out not to be true. So that was going on, and I couldn't worry about all these hassles. There were hassles galore. My whole external life, nothing was working. Absolutely nothing was working. But after a while, it just didn't faze me. And I was having fights with the Peace Corps. I'd set up this meeting with Bala, and I went down to the. We had this seminar at the Peace Corps. It was about 2 weeks before the meeting with Bala, and the whole thing just came to a head. And they said, "Well, look, we don't have any position for you, and we don't want to tolerate what you're doing." And the feeling was mutual on my part. And they said, why don't you swing into New Delhi and talk with the people there, and then come back down to Bangalore, where their headquarters were, and let us know your final decision. Are you going to stay in India, or are you going to leave? And so I thought that was great, because they didn't make me make the decision then, because I knew I wanted to leave. They gave me that time, and that was a very precious time, because in the interim I saw Bala, and then I could leave. So I was in Delhi. I chose the 15th because it worked into my schedule. I was in Delhi on about Wednesday the 13th, or Tuesday the 12th, and I got into Bombay about the 13th, that's on a Wednesday, and then I stayed overnight, and I took the morning train into Pune on Thursday. I didn't know any Bala lovers in India. It never even occurred to me that there were Bala lovers in India. I mean, I was just focused on Bala. And, I mean, let's see, I hadn't seen any films of Bala. I'd read The God Man, I had a copy of God Speaks, and I had discourses in a lot of the books. But it just never occurred that there were Bala lovers in Bangalore and Bombay and Pune and all these other places. So I just checked into a hotel, and, see, the whole thing in these letters made an incredible focus on time. Like in Boston, we have these arguments. Basically because of me all the time about being on time and stuff, but I can assure you that going back through those letters, there is a phenomenal emphasis on time. And Adi would say, you know, it's going to be for 5 minutes, and he'd underline the 5 minutes, and, you know, it's going to be at 9 a.m. sharp, and he'd underline the sharp. And this was repeated 3 or 4 times in those letters that led up to the interview. And you'll see in the middle of the interview, you know, the Bala just reinforced the whole thing about time. So I was fantastically nervous about being late. I thought, you know, here's the meaning of my life. But finally, you know, small kid from Denver gets a break and he blows it. He shows up, you know, an hour late. So I had nightmares about that happening. So I didn't want that to happen. So I asked the people at the desk to wake me up at 5:30. And fortunately, I just spontaneously woke up about that time anyway. So I got dressed and I had some breakfast and I had to find Guru Prasad. I didn't even know where Guru Prasad was. And I asked various people and they directed me here and there. And I finally got to the Bund Garden area, which is a block away. And I went into this hotel and this little kid was there speaking only Marathi. And he went and got the English speaking person. And I said, I want to go to 24 Bund Garden Road. And the man, you know, it's kind of a paunchy English speaking hotel keeper. Oh, yes, I'm here about the bungalow. And so I said, yeah, that's fine. He pointed, he had a whole bunch of pictures on his wall. There was every Indian saint and holy man that I'd ever seen and a lot that I hadn't seen. They were all around. And there was one of Baba nestled in there. He said, oh, that's Mayor Baba dear. So he said, the boy will be taking you to the Gurupradhan. So the boy got on his bicycle and he led me there and then he sort of vanished. So I was there at the gate of Guru Prasad in Pune. And there was didn't seem like any action inside. And I walked in the gate, and as soon as I walked into the gate, this stillness pervaded my being. I was aware of a stillness, because you've probably seen pictures, or those of you who've been to Pune know what the streets are like. I mean, bicycles, taxi rickshaws, taxis, cars, buses, noise, Indians yelling at each other, and the whole thing is very noisy. It certainly isn't quiet place, but Guru Prasad was completely different. There was a peace and there was a quiet so beautiful that you could virtually taste it and touch it. It was that tangible. It was just exquisite. It was wonderful. And so I felt that I had come into contact with something quite wonderful just from that. There was a gardener over there sweeping up and he didn't seem to want to bother with me, so I just kind of walked in. Finally, I saw a guy in slacks and a t-shirt on the veranda, and my first reaction was, well, gee, this anybody who's associated with Mayor Baba wouldn't walk around in his undershirt. I mean, surely dress up a little more casually than that, I mean, a little more formally than that. But it turned out to be Erich. So Erich came over and introduced himself. I don't think there was even a handshake or an embrace or anything like that, but Erich just said, may I know your name? And I felt such a wave of love and a power from Erich that was incredible. And I remember kind of thinking to myself, well, this person is real. This is the first real human being I've ever met in my life. This person really has something. So I was very impressed, because I had been thinking that, I mean, I never saw myself as being Baba. I never saw myself as striving for God realization. The only thing I saw myself as doing is getting out of this terrible rut that I was in back in the States, which was like a dog chasing his tail and getting nowhere and being unhappy about it, and finding some way to be happier. That's all I wanted out of life, is just to learn to live differently so that I could be happy. And so I thought, well, you know, if this is what Baba has done for this man, this is fantastic. I mean, because this guy's got something, and that's great. I'm on the right track. So Erich took me in, and there's a little living room type of place there, and Erich introduced me to Mani, and let's see, Rano came in and said hello, but it was all kind of quick like that. And I was nervous as a cat, but also peaceful. I was both of those things. I was had in my mind all these things that Baba was just gonna look at me and say, well, you know, it's a long way home, my friend. I was steeling myself for, you know, something I had in my mind, kind of a, not that he'd be mean, but that he'd be kind of a, like a Zen master, you know, all right, you know, shape up, kid. I mean, life isn't wandering around India, you know, go back and be a man. I didn't have any feeling for Baba as a human being. I had a feeling for Baba as a master, And I thought Bob was just going to lay it on me. 5 minutes. You want to see what I can do in 5 minutes, kid? Here it is. We were sitting around, and Eric showed me these pictures, and I couldn't concentrate on them very well because my mind was all wrapped up with these kinds of thoughts. And finally, Eric just said, "Baba has come. He wants to see you." That was that. So we walked down the hall, left our sandals at the door, the French door of the room where Baba went, met with the male Mondali, opened, and I had in my mind, I wasn't psychologically prepared to see Baba. I had in my mind that we're going down a corridor and up the stairs and all this, and all of a sudden, you know, Baba was there. He was sitting in a chair, in a sadra, and looking squarely at me, and I was sort of taken aback. I didn't know what to do. Erich had told me, "Look, Baba doesn't want you to take darshan or touch his feet or anything like that. He may embrace you." So that was fine with me because I didn't want any of that religious crap anyway. So that was perfectly fine that Baba said that because I wasn't in for darshan and stuff like that. I'd seen a lot of holy men in the village and people come up and touch their feet, and it really turned me off. So I think Baba was very sensitive about that, and I appreciated that. So, you know, Baba looked at me, just looked at me like that. Like, what are you stalling for? What are you standing there for? You know, and you may say, well, that's just a little, I'm gonna do some editorializing in this. I hope you won't mind. Just what I'm gonna do is just tell you what I get out of it, which I think is kind of as interesting as just hearing what Baba did. I mean, just share with you how I feel about what Baba did to me and kind of what was going on in me to elicit the response that Baba had. You know, I guess you would say that one of my patterns in life was always to think about things a lot, but not to do. And it's an easy rut to get into as a college student and as one who, you know, whose mind is fairly active and so forth. But that's, if you look at the way Baba is dynamic. Baba is in motion. Baba's not a static man, human being at all. He's always gesturing, his hands are always moving, his eyes are always moving, he's always going on to the next person or the next experience or the next feeling. He's not a person who just stands around and thinks. And that's exactly the first thing that Baba went through in me. Like, move. Come here. For some reason, all that stuff in my head didn't matter too much after that. I just sort of fell into Baba's embrace. I didn't expect Baba to embrace me, but in that atmosphere, it seemed like the most natural thing that I'd ever done. I'd say there were very few of any men that I'd ever embraced, but I mean, I didn't even think about it. It was so natural in that atmosphere. There seemed like it was like just lying on your back and floating downstream. It was just that gentle and that natural. And that's another thing, because, you know, I had expected, I guess, initial response from Baba to be heavy. And Baba's initial way of treating me was very, very light, and very tender and very gentle. I'd expected Baba the father, and the first thing I got was Baba the mother. And Baba embraced me. I sat at his feet. And Baba, you know how, I don't know if any of the rest of you are like this, but I mean, sometimes or often when I meet people, I kind of, you know, there's a feeling of kind of uncomfortableness. Well, what do I say? And try to understand the other person and say a few formalities. Hi, what do you do? How are you? That type of thing. There's a kind of an adjustment to the other person going on. I think it's kind of common in relationships when you meet somebody for the first time. But there was none of that with Baba. I mean, it was just like Baba just welcomed me in as if I were, it was the most absolutely natural thing in the world to do. I mean, why shouldn't I be there? There was no barrier. There was nothing to adjust to. And in that room, everything took place in Baba's consciousness, in which there was a tremendous feeling of existence, of experience. And I would say, I mean, people say, now what is the embrace of Baba like? And to me, the embrace of Baba is Baba's consciousness, because the minute I stepped into that room, I was in Baba's consciousness. And Baba's consciousness is at least from what little bit I could take away with me and still remember now, 7 years later, is absolutely the most fulfilling and light and beautiful and tangible thing that I could ever describe. I can't describe it, but it's tremendously uplifting, and I felt whole. I mean, I felt that everything I did and everything I breathed and thought was just taking place in an atmosphere of lightness and beauty and harmony. And that, to me, is Baba's embrace. The physical embrace was like being embraced by a person who really wasn't very attached to his body at all. It was as if the consciousness were there, and the consciousness kind of, it's like, I don't know, you might, like a wave sort of coming up. And, you know, the wave is there, it embraces you on that level, and then it kind of goes down. But the predominant sensation is of being in the water. And so a wave comes up and slaps you, and revolves around you, and then it kind of recedes like that. But you all the time have the sensation of being in the water. It was like that, seeing Baba and having Baba's embrace. So the first question the Baba said is, did I know Richard Alpert? He's now Baba Ram Dass, or Ram Dass. And I didn't know Richard Alpert, and some of the things I'll be telling you about this interview are things which now, many years later, I mean, that, as I said, that meeting, that 5 minutes, was so profound that it's almost a monthly or a weekly phenomenon that I can get something new out of those same 5 minutes. So, I mean, I've had dozens, hundreds, thousands of insights that have helped me in life out of that 5 minutes, which I couldn't possibly share with you. But one of the things that Baba was getting at, see, my reaction as I look back at it now and kind of understand it was, who cares about Richard Alpert? I mean, I'm here for 5 minutes and we're going to talk about Richard Alpert. I've never met the guy. If he wants to take acid and blow his mind, that's fine. If he wants to be a holy man, that's fine with me. Let's talk about me. I mean, I didn't consciously have those things going on in my mind, but that was my attitude. I mean, I figured I get 5 minutes and, you know, I want him to count. So this Baba talking about Richard Alpert. So, I mean, but at the same time, I mean, I was inundated with Baba. I mean, I wasn't going to say that, even though it was at some level of my consciousness, and Baba, of course, knew that. I mean, that Baba was just so overwhelming that I mean, I just found myself without any conscious trying, just doing, going along with it. You just got right in the flow. I mean, it seemed like there was only one thing to do, is just flow with Baba. And so I said, no, I don't know Richard Alpert, but I know who he is. And Baba said that he had received recent communication from Richard Alpert that Richard was going to stop taking drugs. And Baba said, makes him very happy. And at that point, Baba smiled so much, and he seemed to pour so much love in Richard Alpert's direction out there, way out in America somewhere. I mean, it was just a phenomenal example. At the time, I didn't understand it. Now, I understand it to mean exactly what Baba was talking about in the Universal Message and what he said all his life, that the deepest and most beautiful and most practical way to love God is by loving human beings. And that's exactly what Baba was doing. He was giving me a divine example of how to care about and to love another human being. And it was just so phenomenal, like how much Baba gave of himself. It was just like he just gave this incredible amount of love to Richard Alpert. He was really happy that Richard Alpert had stopped taking drugs. Next question was concerned Robert Dreyfus. And Baba wanted to know, had I seen Robert before I left the States? And I explained to Baba that, no, I hadn't. I had left before he had gotten back, and so I hadn't had a chance to see him. And again, it's the same thing, you know, of Baba loving somebody, Baba caring about somebody. And the next question was, where's Diana? Which kind of surprised me because I had written in the letter that she wasn't coming. But again, see, I'd gone to Harvard, so in some way I knew about Richard Alpert, and there's a part I omitted. That point, after Baba asked me about Richard Alpert, he said, don't take drugs. Okay. I had, as I say, taken some drugs I had made up my mind to stop about 8 or 9 months before that. So to me, it didn't come across as an order to somebody who was taking drugs. What happened was I realized that, and something that I wasn't conscious of before that meeting, well, he knows everything about me. That's right. He knows I took those drugs. And immediately after that, there was fear. I mean, like, if any one of you were to let me know that you knew everything about me, I'd be frightened. I mean, what are you going to do with that? I mean, can I trust you? That type of thing, because it's not a usual event in life that you meet somebody who knows everything about you a minute after they met, and who lets you know that he knows. And immediately following that, I would say that what I felt was that I could trust Baba completely. It wasn't a verbal thing, it wasn't an intellectual thing, it wasn't a logical thing, but it was just an experience that I had, that I can trust Baba completely. That Baba has a nature such that he will never harm me. So there was a question about Robert Dreyfus, and I explained to Baba, and then Baba asked about Diana, and I told him that Diana had gone back to her place of work, and Baba said, that's good. She did receive Baba's blessing and love, which he sent to her. And so Baba saying that it was good, I mean, was really wholehearted. There was no doubt about that. But Baba said, you are far more fortunate. And in fact, Mani had used the expression, you know, you were the lucky one, when she found that I was coming and all of that. And that's really what happened. I was one of the lucky ones. So then Baba asked me, had I read Stay With God? I can't remember whether I'd heard about Stay With God or not, but I hadn't read it. And Baba had me stand up, turn around, and he introduced me to Francis Brabazon, who was in the back of the room with several of the other Mandalay. And that was the first time that I became conscious that there were other Mandalay in the room. So it was a whole experience, the whole dynamic of the experience. I mean, I had only thought of me and Baba. That was it. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was going to meet my master, and my master was going to tell me where it was at, and I was going to try to live up to that and go back and put that into practice. I mean, that was my consciousness. But Baba's never alone, and Baba's never without consciousness and thinking about other people. And that's one of the very dramatic lessons that he taught me in that room. Of course, he's concerned about other people, and he wants me to be concerned about other people, and he's being with other people who are in the back of the room, and he loves them, and he shares his love with them, just as he shared it with me. I mean, it's not a separated process. It's an all-inclusive process with Baba. He loves all these people simultaneously. And that was a kind of a dramatic experience of that, whereas I was highly self-centered, and so I didn't. That was a real lesson, I would say. So Baba told me, read Stay With God. So, you know, here it is. A couple of minutes have gone by. I was entranced by Baba's gestures, which were exquisite, just absolutely beautiful. And I was kind of wondering, you know, it's kind of a light conversation so far. I mean, we'll talk about Richard Alpert and Robert Dreyfus and Diana and Stay With God. And it's not what I imagined. It wasn't one of the discourses. It wasn't the secret of life. You know, I thought, when's the heavy stuff going to start? You know, it's what I came for.